Questions and Answers. True belief in God and knowledge of the existence of a higher reality represent a leap in consciousness for most of us modern rationalists. Sai Baba can help many of us make this great leap, and after it is accomplished, the quest for self-realization can begin in earnest, focusing on whatever form one recognizes as an aspect of God, whether it be love, humanistic attitudes, a spiritual mantra, or symbol, or an incarnation of God, or on God as formlessness, naturally loosens the grasp of the senses, emotions, and mind. One tends toward becoming that which one focuses on. Baba directs people to keep conscious contact with whatever experience they have of God, and to meditate on that experience as much as they can. One may engage in the meditation formally, sitting quietly by oneself and trying to make contact with the light within. Or one may practice constant repetition of one of the names of God, so that God is on the tongue at all times. And Baba also teaches that one should relate to every life situation as if it is God, with the same sense of responsibility, devotion, and love. Thus, our daily activity will become a devotional service, and our life an act of worship. Seeing God behind a multitude of forms and names is an exciting new way of relating to the world. As a psychiatrist, I find this attitude powerful enough to lead one away from the world of duality, where everything outside oneself is seen as separate and distinct, apart from oneself, and toward recognizing the one universal principle permeating reality. The attitude also wonderfully encourages growth, because all one's mental and emotional energies are focused on an experience which is continually exhilarating. Distracting and petty thoughts seem to melt away, and one is filled with a sense of peace and expansion. The choice is ours to make, to pick God as the focus of our awareness, rather than worry, pain, conflict, or confusion. We do create our own universe. The trick lies in our discrimination in ordering it, our discipline and will to set ourselves to the task, our faith that we will reach the goal. I used to think, before being awakened to the reality of the existence of God, that a state of being like this was available simply through suggestion, the use of our imagination, and the psychological principles believed to govern conditioning in human behavior. Now I believe that there is actually another force at work, that we are capable in a concrete way of receiving help from spiritual levels of reality. Baba says that if we carry out the spiritual discipline of focusing on God always, trying to take that one step toward Him, He, in His grace and loving kindness, will take 10 steps toward us. Evidently, this is what God has been saying to us throughout the ages. Since meeting Baba, I have developed a very deep trust in the truth of this loving promise. Baba says, quote, "You may say that progress is possible only through my grace, but though my heart is soft as butter, it melts only when there is some warmth in your prayer. Unless you make some disciplined effort, some sadhana, grace cannot descend on you. The yearning, the agony of unfulfilled aim, that is the warmth that melts my heart. This is the anguish that wins grace. Sadhana, spiritual practice, must render you calm, unruffled, poised, balanced. Make your mind cool and comfortable as moonlight, for the moon is the deity holding sway over the mind. Be calm in speech. Be calm in response to malice, caviling, and praise. Calmness of senses, passions, emotions, feelings, impulses, that is real shanti, peace. Baba cautions further, do not be led away by doubt and vain arguments. Do not question how and whether I can do all this. Once Krishna and Arjuna were going together along the open road. Seeing a bird in the sky, Krishna asked Arjuna, is that a dove? Arjuna replied, yes, it is a dove. Krishna then asked him, is it an eagle? Arjuna answered, yes, it is an eagle. No, Arjuna, it looks like a crow to me. Is it not a crow? Arjuna replied, I'm sorry, it is a crow beyond a doubt. Krishna laughed and chided him for his agreeing to whatever suggestion was given. But Arjuna said, forgive me, your words are far more weighty than the evidence of my eyes. You can make it a crow, or a dove, or an eagle. When you say it is a crow, it will be one. Implicit faith is the road to spiritual success. End quote. I have had the opportunity to speak to many groups about Sai Baba. These are some of the questions asked most frequently about him. Question: are there people who have met Baba and doubted him? Answer: there are people who have gone to India to see him who have come back disappointed, and there are Indians who do not believe the stories of his miracles. There are those who criticize and attempt to demean him, but I have only rarely met an individual, no matter what his title and position, who has drawn close to Baba and remains unaffected. The usual response is for one to be deeply impressed. I am awed by the respect he commands. When Baba was 20 years old and becoming known by people outside Puttaparthi, his older brother became quite concerned that gossip and criticism and the selfish interests of others might in some way harm his younger brother. He wrote him about his concerns. Perhaps the clearest insight into the appropriate attitude to take toward this kind of gossip, as well as a clear statement by Baba of his true identity, is to be found in his reply. Dr. N. Kasturi, author of Baba's biography, describes this incident in the book Satya Shivam Sundaram, Part 2, page 7. Quote, Baba was now 20 years of age. His elder brother, Sheshama Raju, the teacher of Telugu, could not quite grasp the mystery of this phenomenon. He watched with increasing consternation and genuine fraternal love the procession of cars that came to the right bank of the river and took his simple village-grown brother away into the cities that glittered beyond the horizon, full of temptations and pitfalls. A few press comments that rose from ignorance pained him. So he wrote a letter to his brother, warning him and imparting to him the lesson he had learned in life about society and human foibles, about fame and its attendants. The reply that Sai Baba wrote to him on the 25th of May, 1947, is in my possession. It is a document that reveals Baba in unmistakable terms, so I must allow you to have it. To all who are devoted to me, although the letter was written to the brother, the reply is addressed to all, including you and me, for it is essential that you and I should know the real nature of the phenomenon that has appeared for our sake. Quote, my dear one, I received the communication that you wrote and sent. I found in it the surging floods of your devotion and affection with the undercurrents of doubt and anxiety, let me tell you that it is impossible to plumb the hearts and discover the natures of jnanis, those who have acquired spiritual wisdom, yogis, ascetics, saints, sages, and the like. People are endowed with a variety of characteristics and mental attitudes, so each one judges according to his own angle, talks and argues in the light of his own nature. But we have to stick to our own right path, our own wisdom, our own resolution, without getting affected by popular appraisal. As the proverb says, it is only the fruit-laden tree that receives the shower of stones from passers-by. The good always provoke the bad into calumny. The bad always provoke the good into derision. This is the nature of this world. One must be surprised if such things do not happen. The people, too, have to be pitied rather than condemned. They do not know. They have no patience to judge aright. They are too full of lust, anger, and conceit to see clearly and know fully. So they write all manner of things. If they only knew, they would not talk or write like that. We, too, should not attach any value to such comments and take them to heart, as you seem to do. Truth will certainly triumph someday. Untruth can never win. Untruth might appear to overpower truth, but its victory will fade away and truth will establish itself. It is not the way of the great to swell when people offer worship and shrink when people scoff. As a matter of fact, no sacred text lays down rules to regulate the lives of the great, describing the habits and attitudes that they must adopt. They themselves know the path they must tread. Their wisdom regulates and makes their acts holy. Self-reliance, beneficial activity, these two are their special marks. They may also be engaged in the promotion of the welfare of devotees and in allotting them the fruits of their actions. Why should you be affected by tangle and worry as long as I am adhering to these two? After all, the praise and blame of the populace do not touch the Atma, the reality. They can touch only the outer physical form. I have a task to foster all mankind and ensure for all of them lives full of ananda, bliss. I have a vow to lead all who stray away from the straight path back again into goodness and save them. I am attached to a work that I love, to remove the sufferings of the poor and grant them what they lack. I have a reason to be proud, for I rescue all who worship and adore me aright. I have my definition of the devotion I expect. Those devoted to me have to treat joy and grief, gain and loss, with equal fortitude. This means that I will never give up those who attach themselves to me. When I am thus engaged in my beneficial task, how can my name ever be tarnished, as you apprehend? I would advise you not to heed such absurd talk. Mahatmas, great souls, do not acquire greatness through someone calling them so. They do not become small when someone calls them small. Only those low ones who revel in opium and Ganga but claim to be unexcelled yogis, only those who quote scriptural texts to justify their gourmandry and pride, only those who are dry as dust scholars, exulting in their casuistry and argumentative skills, will be moved by praise or blame. You must have read life stories of saints and divine personages. In those books, you must have read of even worse falsehoods and more heinous imputations cast against them. This is the lot of Mahatmas everywhere, at all times. Why then do you take these things so much to heart? Have you not heard of dogs that howl at the stars? How long can they go on? Authenticity will soon win. I will not give up my mission, nor my determination. I know I will carry them out. I treat the honor and dishonor, the fame and blame that may be the consequence, with equal equanimity. Internally, I am unconcerned. I act but in the outer world. I talk and move about for the sake of the outer world and for announcing my coming to the people. Else I have no concern even with these. I do not belong to any place. I am not attached to any name. I have no mine or thine. I answer whatever the name you use. I go wherever I am taken. This is my very first vow. I have not disclosed this to anyone so far. For me, the world is something afar, apart. I act and move only for the sake of mankind. No one can comprehend my glory, whoever he is, whatever his method of inquiry, however long his attempt. You can yourself see the full glory in the coming years. Devotees must have patience and forbearance. I am not concerned, nor am I anxious, that these facts should be made known. I have no need to write these words. I wrote them because I felt you will be pained if I do not reply. Thus, your Baba. End quote. Question. Does Baba want people to worship him as God? Answer. Although Sai Baba is attracting a great following, and there is little doubt that he is the form of worship for a rapidly growing religious movement, he seeks neither publicity nor worship of himself. Even though he was born into a Hindu family and frequently speaks to Hindus about their gods and scriptures, he does not preach any one religion to the exclusion of others. I have heard him speak about Christ to Christians, and have heard that he does likewise with people of other faiths. He tries to help the individual see and attain the divinity inherent within himself by heeding the scriptures of his own particular faith, by disciplined meditation and chanting, by gradually stilling the earthly desires of the senses, and by adhering to right action based in truth. He teaches that we are all brothers and sisters with the same central yearning to merge with God, and he shows that this yearning is not the result of any particular church doctrine or any single manifestation of God, but is the reflection of a universal truth within all of us. We must learn to experience this inner truth ourselves. It is our own responsibility, no one else's. We must search for our own higher reality and the God within each of us. Question. You talked about the extensive documentation of Baba's miracles and of his great powers. I can't understand, then, how the Western world can be so uninformed about him. Answer. I don't know how to understand this either, but many of his devotees believe that Baba has willed his relative anonymity. He has said that his time schedule is different from ours, that at times he waits until he can accomplish several things at once, and that he is waiting now for certain situations to develop before revealing himself to the world at large. He simply does not want publicity. I have seen people from many countries wanting to interview or photograph Baba come to the ashram and sit for days in the hot sun without being able to get close to him. They tire and leave. I believe he has complete command over when and how people will learn about him. I feel that he is the world teacher, and the day will soon come when the whole world will know about him. As a child, Baba would dance and sing for the people of the village. He told them stories of a day when people from all over the world would flock to Puttaparthi, and he would be only an orange speck on the horizon. The villagers would no longer be able even to get close to him. They just laughed at this pronouncement from the small child they loved so dearly. Now the prediction has come true. Soon, I'm afraid, this will be true for all of us. Recently, I came across something that amused me. Some reporters from Newsweek magazine had traveled to India to talk to some of the lesser-known gurus and spiritual leaders about their feelings toward the gurus who have come to America and made names for themselves and established a following here. There were, of course, mixed comments, pro and con. But what was so funny to me was a photograph of a spiritual man, an ascetic, bearded and unkempt, lying on a bed of nails. Far in the background were a small picture of Rama, and next to it, a picture of Baba. I had to laugh because this seems to be the most publicity Baba will permit in this country. Here was this man's spiritual leader, Sai Baba, and the picture was no larger than a dot. An hour-long color documentary on Sai Baba with Rod Serling as narrator was produced recently for television, and it contained good footage of Baba materializing objects and showering devotees with love and beauty. Several American devotees testified to his greatness, and I felt the objective film was very informative and powerful. Yet, to my amazement, I find that the company is having difficulty finding someone to distribute it. On the other hand, the March 1975 London Times magazine printed an interesting article on Baba. Word of him is spreading, but the timing of his appearance in the world is under his control. Question. If Sai Baba has so much power, why isn't he helping solve some of the problems in India more quickly? And why doesn't he lessen the suffering of the world in general? Answer. I feel that Sai Baba is creating vast, long-term changes for the better in India, as well as in the world at large. From my experience with him, I know that I can't question his actions or his timetable for change, because what he sees and knows is so much beyond my vision and comprehension. Baba has said, quote, I shall certainly achieve the purpose of this avatar, don't doubt it. I will take my own time to carry out my plans so far as you are concerned. I cannot hurry because you are hurrying. I may sometimes wait until I can achieve 10 things all at once. Just as an engine is not used for hauling one coach, but waits until sufficient haulage in proportion to its capacity is ready. But my word will never fail. It must happen as I will. End quote. Why does God allow suffering to exist? This question remains one of the great mysteries in life, one which I can't begin to fathom. But after meeting Baba, I have come to accept certain spiritual explanations for the meaning and purpose of suffering, and have begun to realize that we, the people of the world, are responsible for righting the wrongs that exist. I believe that there is such a thing as free will, and that suffering in the world is not brought about by God. It is the result of our own choices freely made, and of our own deeds performed in this life, and perhaps even in past lives. In fact, the only way I can begin to make sense out of the suffering of millions of apparently innocent people is by accepting the possibility of reincarnation. I have come to accept on faith the spiritual law of karma. We reap what we sow. We are repaid in kind for our own actions, good as well as bad, and we are responsible through our own choices for bettering our lot in the future. It seems to me that Baba can help us through the difficult period of retribution, and may even be able to eliminate completely one's past karma or present suffering. Why he should choose to do this for one and not another is, of course, beyond me. Even though Baba may choose to eliminate a physical, emotional, or financial problem, he says that this is not his main task. His primary goal is to administer to our spiritual problems and cure the ill that hinders us from seeing our true nature. I believe that the conditions of the world today is due to our own low level of consciousness, in which injustice and suffering are inherent. If we hurt others for gain or sensual gratification, and willingly destroy the land and its creatures for money, prestige, or power, we are at that level of consciousness where suffering comes about. Given our present state of consciousness and degree of awareness, if someone were to rid the world today of all its evils and sufferings, we would inevitably be back in the same mess tomorrow. All of us together must take responsibility for righting the ills of our world. We must stop blaming God for our troubles and start searching for strength within ourselves. It is my belief that in assuming the responsibility ourselves for transcending human suffering, we will not only improve the human condition, but transform it as well into something divine. In this transformation may lie the deepest meaning and purpose of suffering. Although I feel that each individual is responsible for his own suffering, it may be that God allows the condition to exist in the first place, perhaps even intensifies it, as in the case of Job in the Old Testament, to test and teach. Baba has said, quote, "Do you think I would confront you with pain were there not a reason for it? Open your heart to pain as you do now for pleasure, for it is my will wrought by me for your good. Welcome it as a challenge. Do not turn away from it. Turn within and derive the strength to bear it and benefit by it. It is all my plan to drive you by the pangs of unfulfilled need to listen to my voice, which when heard dissolves the ego and the mind with it." End quote. Through my psychiatric practice, I have become aware of how readily people are willing to become dependent on doctors and pills because they don't believe their cure can come from within. And I certainly can't condemn or judge another for not believing that we really have the strength to heal ourselves, because until recently, I didn't believe this myself, although I had been in psychiatry 9 years before I met Baba. I knew that we were supposed to have a vast reservoir of inner strength and creative potential which was largely unused, and that by learning to listen to some sort of voice within ourselves, we could discover the secret to tapping into this source. But although I had treated thousands of patients and gone through my own therapy as well, I had never discovered convincing evidence of a hidden reservoir or an illuminating inner voice. What is this inner voice? Does it really exist? From my experience of Baba and meditation and my growing appreciation of the strength that is derived from devotion, as well as a new awareness of subtler energies within myself, I have come to recognize that an inner voice actually does exist. I believe that we reach a new level of consciousness when, by following it, we become aware that the strength, not merely to heal, but to resurrect ourselves, lies within us. Question: what are some practical, concrete examples of Baba's influence? Answer: there are already over 3,000 Sai Baba centers in India, as well as many others throughout the world, with some 30 centers in the United States. Baba directs people into right conduct. His devotees become interested in doing selfless service in their communities, helping the needy in practical ways with food, clothing, housing, and health care, etc. A number of hospitals, for example, have been constructed in India and dedicated to him. Baba is vitally interested in education and has set a goal of helping to establish 2 new colleges in each Indian state. Already, 4 such colleges have been completed and other facilities have been built or are in the planning stage. Baba himself runs a summer school at Vrindavan. Here, some of the most advanced students from all over India receive a course in spirituality and Indian culture. Question: is Baba profiting in any way from his popularity or his display of powers? Answer: at no time during my 5 visits with Baba has anything of material value been asked of me. In fact, it has been quite the opposite. Each time I have been housed and offered food, and Baba has asked nothing in return but my love. He warns people to beware of the spiritual leader who sells his knowledge like common merchandise, and he points out that if a magician not only collected no money for his demonstrations but gave away everything he materialized, he would soon be out of business. The objects that Baba materializes are indeed given to his devotees to be cherished by them. This attitude toward money seems to me one of the clear signs of his authenticity. Sai Baba's personal needs are minimal. He lives in only 1 sparsely furnished room in the temple at Prashanti Nilayam, eats little more than rice, curds, lentils, and dal, a variety of bean protein, and wears nothing but simple silk or cotton gowns. He reminds devotees that he has no need for an ashram or organization and allows these to develop only for the sake of the devotees. He permits devotees to transport him from place to place and to provide lodging and food, but nothing more. Those who wish to give gifts or spend their time, energy, and money in his behalf, he directs to be of service in their own communities. Question: do you feel that worshiping statues or pictures of human beings smacks of idolatry? Answer: I used to think that I understood such things and could say that one way of worshiping God was reasonable, rational, and right, and another was neurotic or wrong. However, after meeting Baba, I came to recognize that I am a neophyte when it comes to understanding spirituality and the dynamics and techniques of expanding consciousness. I was reared in the Jewish religion with the idea that God is formless, and therefore one should not worship golden idols or the human form. Within this attitude, little if any emphasis was placed on the possibility of actually making contact with God, formless or not. This was unfortunate, for I now see that there is much in Judaism which teaches closer contact with and awareness of God. But this is considered a mystical side of Judaism and is given little popular expression. The Hindu religion allows for a great range and variety in ways of relating to God, and I now feel very comfortable with these Hindu views. Baba teaches that God is the fundamental aspect of all forms, and if we can learn to appreciate this, then whatever form we direct ourselves to will eventually bring us to God. Ramakrishna, a revered Indian saint, began his spiritual search picking as his focus and form for God that of the universal mother, the goddess Kali. He worshipped her in the form of a statue, which he fed, bathed, sang to, and cared for completely. His yearning for Kali to express herself to him through this form grew in intensity until he simply couldn't tolerate his separation from her. Finally, his worship and devotion became so all-consuming that, unable to exist a moment longer without making contact with her, he picked up a knife to kill himself. It was then, at the height of his greatest agony, that Kali finally appeared to Ramakrishna, transforming his misery to total bliss. He had realized the supreme spiritual experience. The sheer amount of ecstasy in this kind of experience distinguishes it from a negative or disorganizing state, but what distinguishes it from the imaginary, from wish fulfillment or hallucination, to mark it as authentic, objective spiritual experience. For one thing, when people have this kind of transcendental experience, they describe similar experiences regarding what has happened to their consciousness, what they have seen, and what they then believe and feel that they know about who they are. They recognize that they are more than the body, that they are not attached to the physical plane of existence, and they describe another dimension perceived and glimpsed during their experience in strikingly similar terms. Another significant fact is that during such an experience, people often gain access to information about events of the past, present, and future, which they have no normal way of knowing about. This information, when tested by others who have not experienced the transcendental state, often proves to be true, or what we presume to call true. Ramakrishna went on to realize divinity in other forms and by different methods of worship. He yearned to experience Lord Rama as Hanuman had in the Ramayana, the classic Hindu scripture of the life of Rama, an incarnation of God supposed to have lived a million years ago. Hanuman, a being in the form of a monkey, exemplifies pure devotion in his worship of Lord Rama. When Ramakrishna attempted to experience Rama as Hanuman had, he became so involved in his intense devotion that he began adopting the characteristics of a monkey. Finally, he was once again blessed with a vision of the divine, this time with Rama as a focal form. Then he wished to experience Lord Krishna as the gopis, milkmaids, had when they lived with and worshipped this great Hindu deity. Worshipping Krishna from the standpoint of a woman He began to look and act like one, until he was actually considered a woman by others. He developed a woman's yearning for the experience of Krishna, and was finally blessed with a vision of him. He could visualize him moving about and playing and even entering his body, at which time he felt himself become Krishna. Ramakrishna then wished to experience Christ and began to worship and yearn for him with the same intensity of his search for God in the other forms. As before, he was eventually blessed with a vision of the Christ form of God, an incarnation of pure love. Ramakrishna was aware that God could also be experienced as formless, and he apparently accomplished this as well. He was elevated to such high levels of ecstasy and expanded consciousness that he often appeared to be absent from his body, his longest absence an extraordinary 6 months. During this period, his body had to be cared for by his devotees and close friends. Baba has said, there is a state so high that one has only 21 days left to live when it is reached. One loses interest in choosing pleasure over pain, eating over not eating. The body dries up, and only spirit is left. If one remains on earth, it is only because of God's will. One exists beyond karma and becomes a brilliant reflection of the divine, a teacher of teachers. Such were the heights that Ramakrishna reportedly reached. I now believe that one can evolve along the spiritual path, worshipping any form or no form, as long as it represents for the individual that which is divine. And it seems to me that in regard to this form, one can adopt whatever relationship effectively brings one closer to attaining that divinity in his own life. God may be seen as mother, father, master, servant, or friend. I do not believe that one needs a teacher if one's own intuition isn't sufficiently developed. It is helpful to have a guru in the outside world. One must be very cautious of whom he picks, however. Baba has said, there are very few genuine gurus nowadays. Quote, the holy man must teach by example, and there are very few who earn this respect. How can a man, struggling in the same quicksand as all the others, with attachments like the others, earn the right to be called teacher and be qualified to pull the others out of the quicksand? There are very few genuine spiritual leaders these days. One must turn directly to God for guidance. End quote. Question. How long is Baba going to live? Answer. He says he will leave his physical body at the age of 95. He will come again, he says, and in his next form be called Prema Sai Baba. Prema is the Sanskrit word for love. He admonishes us not to be fooled, that he is not limited to this body or form, but is in fact immortal, eternal, infinite. He says that in this form, his mission is to usher in a golden age, and that during our time, the world will witness an exciting spiritual revolution.